You don't have to be positive all the time. It's perfectly okay to feel sad, angry, annoyed, frustrated, scared, and anxious. Having feelings doesn't make you a negative person. It doesn't even make you weak. It makes you human. And we are here to talk through it all. We welcome you to These Fucking Feelings Podcast, a safe space for all who needs it. Grab a drink and take a seat. The session begins now.
What up, guys? Welcome to These Fucking Feelings Podcast. I am Micah. I got my girl Rebecca here with me. And today we got our guest on, who is also a mental health advocate, Jonathan Nisel, right?
You got it. Yes, I am.
I be practicing people's names, right? Because I'm dyslexic.
I appreciate it. That's not an easy one to get. It's a weird one. But thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate you guys inviting me on.
No problem. And so one thing we do like to do here is we ask our guests to introduce themselves. I feel like it's the best way for our audience to get to know you.
Sure. So I'm coming to you from Texas. I'm originally from Canada, though. I've lived here since April 2019. I am a model. I'm a real estate investor. And I'm also a certified personal trainer. I'm an Aries. I grew up on a farm just outside of Toronto, like you guys are saying, like we were talking about before the recording started. Yeah, just very laid back guy. Like I said, I'm starting to talk more about mental health and use my social media platform to talk a bit more about my life story and things that I've been through. And I'm, you know, really passionate about that and you know, lowering the veil of social media and like really getting, you know, the real stuff out there, just to not the whole everything that glitters is gold and what you see on the surface kind of stuff. So yeah, that's about it.
And also, break stigmas when you get to see like a person, you know, like yourself, real estate, fit, what you call that stuff, working out, I think is what they call it, you know.
Yeah,
I don't do it.
Yeah,
so but no, it's cool when you see, like, it's funny, but a lot of men, if they don't host the podcast show, then they normally don't speak on it. So when I think about the number of women we have compared to men, like, it's few and far in between. So thank you for coming on and to be willing to share your story.
Yeah, my pleasure. I think, like I said, it's a really important thing to, yeah, like you said, break the stigma. You're absolutely right. And to show that, you know, this kind of stuff happens to everybody, and we all have a, you know, predisposition to judge a book by its cover. And like you said, you don't know what people are going through, what they've gone through. And yeah, I'm sure we'll get really, really deep into that. So I won't go too much right now.
But so how long have you actually taken the journey to start talking about mental health?
So it's really within the last, I'd say the last 6 months to a year. I mean, talking about it publicly, I started going to therapy and stuff like that and doing that when probably 6 years ago, when I realized that all the stuff that I was doing to try and mask my mental health and to try and not deal with my fucking feelings was not working. But in the last 6 months, it's like I said, it's been more recent. And there are certain things that I talk about now that I've gone through in my life that I just thought I was going to take to my grave because of, like you said, the embarrassment of, you know, being a guy and having gone through these things, or breaking the facade of, you know, everybody's whatever they, what, you know, what you see. And so it's a newer thing. And
signs of weakness is, and a little boy fell and he was crying and his dad was like, "Are you a little girl? Are you a little girl? And little girls cry." I'm like, "Bro, chill out. He's bleeding. Like, yeah. I'm about to cry and I didn't even fall."
Yeah.
So actually, I was watching your Instagram and I saw that you like broke your story up in two parts and you were kind of sharing it with everybody. Can you tell us a little bit about that now? So,
sure. So I guess I'll start where it all really gets started. Like I said before, about my upbringing, I was raised on a farm. I had a wonderful upbringing, a 500-acre cattle farm. But there's a very decisive day where my life changed completely and took a pretty dark turn. And that was the day before my 21st birthday. And it was a regular day like any other. I'd moved back from college and I had just moved out of my house to get my first big boy job. I was selling cars at a Ford dealership, and I had the morning off. I was going to buy some fish for my tropical fish tank. And I remember as I'm walking to the building, I got a call. It's a home number. And I figure it's just, you know, they're calling just to like plan my birthday celebration for the next day to come visit me. And it was, "Hey, Jonathan, are you by yourself?" And I'm like,
Well, yeah, I guess I'm just about to walk in the fish store and it was, your mom's dead. And I was like, what do you mean my mom's dead? Like, she wasn't sick. She wasn't like, it was just an absolute, like, complete, you know, shock. And it was completely devastating, tragic. My mom was my best friend, my biggest supporter. She and I had a wonderful relationship. And like I said, it was so sudden. I went through all the emotions initially, mostly denial. And I was like, you're wrong. I'm going to prove you're wrong. You know, calling whatever hospital, calling whoever I could, like, to try and prove wrong. And then finally, it was proved to be right. And I remember that day so clearly, like, you know, once I found out and then having to go to the funeral home and start to do all these things and you know, your head spinning and everything's going crazy. And I remember looking around and seeing, like, the gas station's open and, you know, the Wendy's drive-thru is filled up. And I'm like, what are these people doing? Like, don't they understand what just happened? Like, why is the world still working? Like, what is going on here? Like, shut it down, man. Like, my life as I know it has ended. How is this happening? And that was the first time that I learned that that's the world and that's life. You know, you don't know who are going through these days or who's, you don't know people's situations and you don't know. And, you know, people are just going about their day, going through whatever, and you really don't know. So that's why I'm a really big advocate of leading with grace and treating people with respect. And I don't care if it's the person who delivers your food to your door or if it's the person you work for or whatever. I think everybody deserves your utmost respect. And that was a big one for me. So yeah, I kind of tried to keep it together for the next couple of years, but slowly started to deal with mental health issues. I was diagnosed with having severe anxiety and clinical depression and self-harm and panic disorder. I didn't know what was going on because back then, it was 20 years ago, it wasn't talked about. Mental health wasn't talked about. I didn't know the words anxiety or whatever. And like you said, I mean, I was raised, you know, with my parents, it was pushed through. Like, they weren't bad people. And it's just, it wasn't as, they didn't have the tools either. They weren't taught the tools. They couldn't pass it along to me. Only thing they knew was put your head down and keep moving. And I just thought I was going crazy. I was like, oh, I'm losing it. Like, I'm absolutely losing it. I don't know what's happening to me, what. So finally diagnosed with those things. So I started to try to educate myself. And that's a big thing I always talk about with people is if you find out that you're going through something and you're dealing with something and not just a bad day or you know, stress, and but you find out you have anxiety or you have depression, educate yourself on what that looks like and why your body and your mind are doing certain things. And so that way you can deal with it better when you're in the moment and you're feeling panicked and you're having physical reactions to it. And then you're like, oh, I understand now. But that took me years to learn because I figured my first step was, hey, this is a lot easier when I drink, like, oh, I don't know, 15 to 30 beers at a time. Like, I'm just going to, you know, get wasted and all my feelings magically disappear until I sober up. And then they come right back. And then I have more problems. And
it's harder when they come back. It's like feeling it all again from not feeling it to, like, now you're reliving it.
It's exactly it. You're reliving it. And then, like, add on the stuff that you did when you were, like, when I was wasted. Like, and, you know, acting a fool and causing, starting stuff with, like, my family or girlfriends or whatever. Like, all that kind of stuff. So it's like, yeah, you're just resetting, but the easiest thing to do is to keep drinking. So, you know, one of those things, and I just did that for years and quickly became a non-functioning alcoholic. And I say I was non-functioning because it was ruining my relationships with my, like I said, my friends, family. It was ruining my work. It was ruining my health. It was ruining my finances. It was ruining I was a professional lacrosse player. It was ruining my passion for sports. It was taking everything away from me. And I knew exactly why. I knew what was doing it. But it had a grip on me.
Did you know that you were this non-functional alcoholic, or did you think you were functioning okay?
Oh, I thought I was. I started to notice even for myself. I remember the day that I told myself that I was an alcoholic and admitted to myself, because other people had told me. And I was like, yeah, whatever. Yeah, I can outdrink you. I guess that's just a compliment. Like, thanks. But I remember it was like 8 o'clock in the morning, and I called in sick from work because I would get the shakes in the morning. I would get from withdrawals, and it's 8 o'clock in the morning. I'm cracking my first beer for the day, and I'm like, what am I doing? Like, this is not what I'm supposed to be doing. This is not my life. Like, I'm an alcoholic. I know that I can now admit that I'm an alcoholic. I don't know how I'm going to fix it, but I knew it had, its grips on me and had taken control. And it was, like I said, that's when I started to realize, like, and look around, and I was 265 pounds, 40% body fat. I was, like I said, everything around me was crumbling. But as soon as I got back into that safe space of, you know, inebriation, then everything kind of was okay. But that was the first time. And I remember just being so destitute and so broken and just being like, man, like, I don't know where to go from here. And I didn't know. So I just kept drinking. And I'm very, very lucky because I got a very bad case of acute pancreatitis. And that's severe inflammation of the pancreas and usually brought on by drinking, brought on by other things. But in my case, it was definitely from drinking. And one day I was drinking by myself and it was the night before Canadian Thanksgiving. And I remember started to get like a little pain in my stomach. So I was like, eh, whatever, I'll just drink through it. And as the night went on, it got worse. And then by 6 in the morning, it was like, man, I've got really bad gas pains or something. And by 10 o'clock, I had checked myself into the ER and took me about a day to realize what it was. And from there, I spent just under a month in the hospital. I had to have 5 blood transfusions. In total, I lost 60 pounds. I lost 40 pounds in the first 2 weeks. And I almost died twice. And that was a huge wake-up call for me. That was one of the
points that you started to wake up here.
Yeah, that was one of them. I mean, I've had dozens of rock bottoms throughout my life because unfortunately, otherwise our interview would be over and be like, hey, nice talking to you. Click. But there's a lot more to this story, but it was definitely, I'm so grateful for that it happened because like I said before, I knew that I was an alcoholic, but I didn't know how I was going to quit. And I have all the admiration in the world for people who can choose the path of, if they need to. Again, I'm not a preaching not drink. I don't think everybody should not drink or be sober. That's not at all. For me, it wasn't but people who realize, like I have some close friends who realized that they were getting to a point where it was becoming a problem and they chose to, you know, stop. And I think that's incredible because it took me that severity for me to get the picture and to realize that alcohol couldn't be a part of my life anymore. And that was 16 years ago in October. It was 16 October or something. It was 16 years ago that happened. So I haven't touched a sip of alcohol since then.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate it.
It makes me think of my relationship with fruit roll-ups. I mean, I wake up.
We're going to compare alcoholism.
No. We're really not. However, I do wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, eat one, and then go back to sleep, and then wake up in the morning and eat one again.
Exactly. It's very similar behavior for sure. For sure. And I do love a good fruit roll-up. Yeah. So it was, so I got sober from alcohol and my life started to immediately look and feel better. I got scared straight about my body and learning that, you know, things come from the inside out. And that's where my passion for fitness started. I wanted to learn more about the body and like how it works and taking better care of it. And like, hey, I'm still alive at 25 after going through that. And I was eating garbage food and fast food and all kinds of stuff and maybe fruit roll up or two. One or two. We'll talk later. But I just, started to realize like, hey, if you put better stuff in your body, you know, within moderation, like you learn, but you'll get better results from it. I started going back to the gym and playing lacrosse. I had a career-ending lacrosse knee injury, but I was 26 at the time. It wasn't paying as a profession. It was a lot of fun, but you know, it's a very rough sport and there's a lot of fighting and stuff. So going to work, like my real job with black eyes and stitches and stuff on a regular basis was kind of getting old. So I was like, okay, maybe it's time to like, you know, call it a career. And
that you were playing lacrosse, like he in a game.
Yeah, exactly right. My dad came to the first game that I finally made this local pro team and he's like, all right, I'm coming. I got in a fight, and I remember I was getting beat up. Like I've won a lot of fights, but I've lost a lot of fights too. And I was getting just pummeled by this guy. And I remember looking down at the ground and just seeing like blood trailing around. And after the game, I was like, hey, what'd you think? You know, before I go to the hospital, he's like, this is what you want to do? Really? I'm like, yeah, it's great, isn't it? He's like, meanwhile, my parents got me into lacrosse when I was young and hockey and all that stuff. But so I had a better appreciation for fitness. I got into better shape. And then I thought I would look into doing some modeling. And my mom had been a model in the late 70s and early 80s. So I'd had an interest from her fashion background. And I thought, you know, Crystal, like said, I wasn't so bad on the hard on the eyes. So I was like, hey, maybe I'll check out some agencies or something. And I ended up going to a couple agencies in Toronto, got some offers, and then I started modeling professionally. And that was my first contract. And I had the ability to start traveling pretty soon after. My first stop was Cape Town. It was wonderful. It was 6 months in there. It was absolutely incredible. I could, you know, spend a whole podcast just telling you about that. But the one thing that I started to notice, and I started to plant the seed in my own head of body dysmorphia, because when I saw all these people on these magazines, you know, like guys that I was comparing myself to, I'm like, oh, these guys are jacked, they're ripped, all this kind of stuff. So I was still working out like a professional athlete. I was using fitness as a distraction in place of alcohol, which I didn't realize until later. I'm like, it's working out, it's healthy. You can't do too much of it. Well, you can, I mean, but I got there around all these other international models, and I'm like, you know, twice the size of them, and I'm still booking work and I'm still doing well, but I started to plant the seed of like, and that's why I think it's so important, like we're talking about getting rid of this whole social media thing, that comparison of, oh, well, they booked that job. Maybe if I looked a bit more like so-and-so, I would book that job, including these other jobs. And maybe so I started to plant that body dysmorphia like seed in my head. And so I left South Africa after 6 months, went back to Canada in the middle of the winter, miserable, but I quickly drove to Miami. That was my next stop, was Miami. And I had only been in Miami for 2 days. And yeah, I was like, my first major US, like, in you know, place stop. Like, I'm in a big market. I'm in a major market here. I've got a Miami agency. Like, I'm ready to make this happen. So I was there for 2 days. And I remember my agency, I'm looking for a house. I'm trying to, or a place to live and all that kind of stuff. My agency's like, we've got a go-see for you. So I don't know if you guys know what go-see is, but like, it's like a casting, like specifically for you. If you're new in town, or if you've had some new pictures or something, that a director or a photographer or designer will say, we want to meet with him and try some clothes on or whatever. So I was like, they had a go-see program. I'm like, great. 2 days in, I'm already got, you know, stuff. But they said, it's going to be at this guy's house at like 8:30 at night, red flag. And my agent proceeded to tell me, this guy is a bit of a creep. And I was like, okay, well, all right. So I go in and, you know, I shoot all kinds of stuff, but, you know, there are some people who are body guys in the industry who, you know, have better built or have bodies and shoot more underwear and swimwear stuff. And I've always been a body guy. And so it wasn't weird for me to go to a casting and to, you know, strip down and get into like a pair of briefs and come back out and, you know, that kind of stuff. So that was pretty normal stuff. But after a couple of times of going in the bathroom and coming back out, he started to make, you know, some uncomfortable comments and, you know, make some like inappropriate references to my anatomy, and came back out, and then he sexually assaulted me. And I was like, what is going on right now? Like, in the moment, I was just frozen, like completely frozen. Like, what is happening right now? And then when I finally came to about my next step with, you know, with my background in like lacrosse and, you know, my mom died, I had a lot of misplaced anger. So I've been in a lot of fights and stuff like that. I was like, oh, I'm going to beat the crap out of this guy. Like, I'm going to beat this guy to death. And I was like, okay, well, you can't do that because you'll probably get charged and it's his word against yours. And now I'm
really hoping that it, like, the story I knew was coming to that. You knocked him out.
And I know,
big bottle.
But like I said, I thought, I'm like, I'm going to get charged with attempted murder because I don't know if didn't know where the stopping point was. Like, So I just figured, okay, I need to get out of here. I need to get out of the situation. I got myself out of the situation, said, you know, do not touch me. Like, just get away from me. I left. And, but I didn't think to report, like, talk to my agency about it, because this is before the Me Too movement. So it was like,
the Wild West out there. So I, first of all, I was embarrassed. I also didn't want to be labeled as a troublemaker, because that's the way that it worked in markets, is like these things would happen and there'd be kind of like the under, you know, the kind of talking between the designers and the photographers and stuff like that who did this kind of stuff. And if somebody threw up a red flag or caused trouble, then all of a sudden you're shut down. Like, you're blacklisted. So I'm like, I just got to Miami. Not to mention, though, I was ashamed. I was embarrassed. I was confused. I was...
Men can't be sexually assaulted. And there's always that thing also, like, who believes that a man was sexually assaulted? It's always such a big thing with that.
That's exactly it. And, like, so many people have asked me, like, in, like, I'm only... recently started talking about it, but they're like, well, why didn't you just eat him up? You know, you're such a, you know, good fighter and stuff. I'm like, you don't understand. When I was in the moment, when that was happening, like, I was like, that was exactly my, I was like, what is going on right now? There's no way this is happening to me right now. So I just internalized it. And about 2 weeks later, I guess, like, my demons were just like becoming too much, and the body dysmorphia was becoming too much. And that's when I started an 8-year battle with an eating disorder, because I figured, okay, I need to make a drastic change now to get work in Miami. And I needed some kind of a release, like the same way that like getting drunk would be. Like, I always say that I was a functioning bulimic. Like, I'd wake up in the morning, I'd eat all my normal meals, all my healthy stuff. I would do all that. It'd be fine. And then whenever I found myself alone with my thoughts in my place, in my four walls, it was like, oh, I can't be with my feelings. Like, there's no way. So I would go get like $100 worth of junk food or something, or however much, and just eat garbage and then immediately regret it and purge it up. And that was an absolute cycle, because of, you know, just it was another distraction, another release of a way to, you know, escape my feelings and to, you know, just, you know, disassociate or just take me away for a minute. So yeah, I did that for a long time. And those are the two things that I never thought I would ever talk about out loud. Like, I would talk to people about my alcoholism. I'll talk about like mental health and stuff. But those two things, because the stigmas behind them, like you're saying, like, and like, I never thought that I would ever talk about those two things publicly, because I'm like, oh, people are going to think this, or people are going to think that. And like, as I've gotten older and as I've come to terms with, and I'll talk about forgiveness later because that's a big part of it. But I realized that like these things need to be talked about, and they need to be talked about by sometimes the people that you least expect to talk about them, and to talk like to have gone through them, and to, like I said, like we said, like keep saying, dropping the stigma of, and just knowing that these things happen. So I traveled quite a bit more.
A bit of a renaissance.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, Crystal might say that, but.
I was just thinking, like, what hasn't he done? He did the cross, he was a model, got the real estate, cars. He didn't even say that in his introduction. It's like, you done it all. You know, you done beat people up. So, like, all the things I wish I could have done.
I look back at some of the stuff that I've done and some of the crazy situations that I've gotten myself in, or just the things that I've, like you said, I've done. And I'm like, man, I'm over here, I'm just living a life. But I mean, there are 15 years of that were, you know, very dark, where I was just trying my best. Yeah. And so I go from Miami, I go to New York next. And right after New York, I get called to go to London, England after Fashion Week. And, you know, I'm over there and come back to New York, and I'm like, just, you know, just doing pretty well, like really doing well as an international model and loving it. But I started to notice every time I'd stop, like go back home for a little bit, back to Toronto or back to Canada, you know, I'd miss my father, and I don't miss my friends, and notice that everybody's lives just keep going. And I'm, you know, living out of a suitcase for like a few years kind of starts to wear on you a little bit. So I decided I needed to put down roots. Fitness, like I said, was very important to me. So I wanted to start my own fitness business. I wanted to get a dog, who I still have, my wonderful little Bailey. But that's when I put down roots and decided to stay in Toronto and stop traveling for a bit. And everything was great for a bit, again, which is kind of a theme, you know, everything's great for a bit. And
right.
Because I had that distraction of traveling. Traveling was a distraction. The new places and the new, you know, you get to a new city and you know,
you have to find a new gym and a new corner store, and you meet new people and you new friend and new relationships and all that kind of stuff. And then I settled into, you know, regular life of, you know, just being in Toronto and stuff. And then those fucking feelings, man, they just kept creeping up. And I was like, okay, I need to turn to drugs now. And it started out with weed smoking. I'd smoked weed in college and like when I was younger and stuff. But I started smoking a ton of weed, like 2 ounces a week by myself, like just a ton of weed, just couldn't function without it. I'd go throughout my day and be fine and stuff. When I came home, the anxiety would start to creep up and then it'd be like, I need to get away from these feelings. So I'd smoke. And then, I was addicted to that. And that was a big one. Adderall was a big, big one for me because it's like, hey, you want to stay in shape and be productive? Have you tried legal meth? From the makers of so-and-so, we'd bring you Adderall. Like, this is great. I can lose weight and I can scrub my floor tiles for 8 hours at a time and have fun doing it. Like, this is incredible.
People always say it's like awesome.
Oh, it is until it's not, until it gets scary. Like I was literally on my hands and knees for 8 hours with a toothbrush scrubbing the grout on my floor tiles and having the time of my life. But I had been up for like 3 days. I would be up for like 3 or 4 days at a time. It was nuts, man. It was absolutely nuts. And I was always with my drinking and with my drugs and stuff like that. I was very insular. Like I was very much like, it wasn't like, hey, let's go out and get like, you know, go out and party and I invite everybody over. I was like, oh, I've got these feelings and I need to like, I'm alone and I need to like do something about it. So it was that, it was Adderall as well. And then I was hooked on nitrous, on Whippets as well, because I did those in college and I was like, well, to bring those back, those things, you know, help you disappear and kill some brain cells at the same time. But, you know, you don't feel your feelings. It's better than feeling your feelings. And the final straw for me was I was taking an over-the-counter muscle relaxer. And the one thing I will give myself credit for is I was very good at staying on the baseline drugs. Like, I mean, Adderall is kind of aggressive, but for the most part, staying on the baseline, because I knew the moment that I shot heroin or did coke or anything, like graduated to the next level, or took Oxy, whatever, or Hydra, whatever they're called, I knew that my life would be over. I knew with my addictive personality, with my demons that I wasn't dealing with, I knew that my life would be over.
Sounds like you have a very addictive personality.
Oh, big time. And it's in me and it's a genetic thing. It comes from my mom's side. My parents would notice it at a young age. When I wanted to do something like play lacrosse, I was like, I had to go. I was obsessed. Like you and for roll-ups.
Well, you know, I was thinking about lacrosse and I was thinking about, you was talking about the fights and like your dad saying like, this is what you want to do. And I was like, dad, to me, that was like a mental health moment because it is a good question. Like you're bleeding. Okay. Yeah. And you want to come back tomorrow?
Yeah, exactly. No, that's exactly it. And yeah, it was always my way with things. Like I was really good at school when I focused on it, but I was more interested in like sports and stuff like that. And I would just get like very focused. And so I finally, my body was telling me that these things were bad for me. Like weed started to turn on me. It was like my sanctuary. And then it started to become like paranoia and anxiety and like really uncomfortable. And I had some really bad experiences with it where I was like, okay, I'm done with that. That felt awful. And same with the Adderall. But I had dozens of rock bottoms because I get to the point where I was like, I look at the life I'm living, I dump out my Adderall in the toilet, dump out my weed, flush it, and I'd be like, that's it, I'm done. And then a couple days later, I'd be like, man, here come these feelings again, and right, they creep up. But so I need big events to really get the idea, like with pancreatitis and stuff like that. So weed had some really bad experiences that I'm going to the hospital just because I was freaking out. And it was like a really bad experience on really bad trip on weed. And then same with the Adderall, started noticing. And then, but I'd always taken these back pills and they're over the counter, just buy them on the off the shelf, regular old back medicine. And they had 500 milligrams of methocarbamol. That was the active like muscle releaser. And they had 200 milligrams of ibuprofen in each pill. And I took them for, you know, lacrosse aches or like fitness pain, you know, stuff like that, like for years and years. And then I was left with no other other vices to fall back on. So I was like, oh, I'm going to go all in on these pills. So it's amazing what the body can tolerate. But I, in the span of like a month and a half, month or 2 months, I went from taking, like, it says don't take more than 8 per day. I went from taking like 8 per day to 100 pills every single day. I would take 50,000 milligrams of methocarbamol and 20,000 milligrams of ibuprofen every single day. And I'm not being hyperbolic. I'm not proud of it. It's not not a brag at all. But I would buy a generic bottle. It was like $38 and change. And I would just go home. I'd dump out, a handful of 30 or 40, pop them in, swallow them. And every single day I'd go through 100 and I'd go back the next day. And I start doing the math.
You need organs. It's like you shouldn't have with the drinking and the cream over your kidneys.
Tell me about it.
That thing probably is what saved you. Maybe being healthy saved you from all those things.
That's the thing. That's the thing, is because eating very healthy, when I wasn't, doing my bulimia stuff, I was still eating healthy and keeping that down. And I've always been very good at taking my vitamins. I always wake up in the morning and take my vitamins and also eating healthy. But yeah, with all this, throwing this other stuff at it. So I started to lose weight like crazy. And the next day I'd be kind of lethargic and I'd be like, oh, I'm just probably feeling the effects of having 100 pills the day before. But I started having fainting spells. And I remember I fainted in my house and cracked my head open and came to. And I should have gotten stitches, but I never ended up getting stitches. And I woke up and my dog's licking my face and I'm just laying on the ground, big pool of blood. And then my anxiety starts going through the roof because I start thinking, oh, I'm going to this is going to happen in public or when I'm driving and I'm going to hurt somebody or cause a scene. But I was like, it's got to be something else. And I was losing weight. I had no energy. I was like, you know what? You're just being a wimp. Push through it. You just probably don't have enough carbs. Go eat this, do that. Anything to, it was anything else except for the obvious, what was going on. And finally, I got to the point. I remember I was on a shoot, and I was shooting a cover of a romance novel, and I've done a bunch of romance novels.
How cool is that?
She's probably read it. She said you look familiar.
Yeah, I've been on the cover of over 150 romance novels. They used to be great. When I was in Toronto, they were a great gig, really great to work with. They're wonderful people. So.
Did they? Oh. Novels.
Crystal, I will send you a list of the titles.
Yeah, good.
Oh my God, this was funny.
Okay, so I don't know which one is worse. The fact that you have a list or that Rebecca just did it to everybody. And I mean, you were pretty good on our download. And know that you read romance novels.
Of course I do. What woman doesn't? I want to know this.
I feel like
immediately.
Don't admit in public.
No, but that's the thing though. What about 50 Shades of Grey? That came out and everybody was like, oh, and it's like, what are you talking about? They've been doing this for years. Harley Quinn's been doing this for years.
Don't watch that, then there's something wrong with it.
Bray was a little sexy because he was choking her and shit. So that was different.
Okay, now we're gonna. I'm not choking anybody. I'm just reading a novel.
If people like that, and 50 Shades of Grey allow them to like it in public.
Yeah. How
did this conversation take a turn?
Because we talk about drinking, and he was Jonathan was saying.
Explain it.
I don't know what I was just saying, but I did want to bring this point because Jonathan was saying he's not saying drinking is bad. It's just kind of bad for him. It's like anything else, kind of like the sadistic stuff that people like and that BDSM and shit. I mean, choke me every now and then, brother.
I got this.
But also to me, I actually found myself because of weed. Weed allowed me to open myself up to accept all of me. It was most people, reaction that people have with weed, I don't have. I do weed or smoke weed or whatever, and I want to build a house. I don't get lazy. I become productive.
Yeah.
And now I'm designing stuff. I think this podcast was made off of weed. But it also, it was at the lowest moment of my life, too, that I decided. I also am a cancer survivor, and I had cancer. So, wow. For years, doctors been trying to push medical marijuana on me.
Right.
And but I was one of those people that it didn't matter what drug you did, you was a crackhead. So, I didn't want to be a crackhead doing weed. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But finally, one day, it was kind of me at my lowest point. I didn't want to go through, similar things, the anxiety and depression, and I was going through that, and people wanted to prescribe medicine, but I had been out of control of my body for so long because of my ailments that now that I had control, I didn't want to be under something else that controlled it. So that was my issue.
Yeah.
But anyway, I finally decided to like, okay, I was going to try weed. And I'm telling you, when I tell you it changed my life, like it did, but it allowed me to like visit things. What's wrong, Rebecca? They'll be laughing at me. It allowed me to like visit places, really, really dark places that I wouldn't visit because I knew to stay away from it when I was sober.
Oh, yeah. No, totally. I totally get that. I totally respect that. And yeah,
it helped me deal with a lot of trauma and get out a lot of trauma that now I'm okay. Like, I don't, you know, I'm still on my healing journey, but I'm pretty much okay.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's, I definitely, like you said, I'm not a preacher. I'm not preachy. Like, I don't think that the things that I do or did or whatever, everybody should not do. And I do see a lot of validity. I've heard that a lot. And I do think that there's a very, like, it works. And it's that's the thing is, as individuals, that's what's wonderful about it is what works for us and us as individuals.
I think we have to judge things on the harm. If it's causing you harm and is making you not safe, then it's something you need to visit, no matter what it is.
Yeah.
And for everybody, yeah, you know, mine is my love of roll-ups. I'm going to end up being a diabetic. But
right.
I know that.
Your teeth will fall out. I'm not sure what.
Girl, I'm really worried about these teeth. I'm about to go buy some. But
no, it's exactly it.
The diabetic part, okay?
Yeah. And I will say, in my defense, I don't have a list of the Roy-S novels that I shot. So whenever I'd see them in the store, I'd buy them. So I have a bookshelf with about like 150 of these romance novels and that I've never read before. People, whenever they see it, they're like, have you read these? I was like, no, but I'm on the cover dressed as like, you know, all these different characters and stuff. And people are like, is it weird?
You got blonde
hair. Yeah, I don't think I did. They put me ponytail on me a few times. My hair was long, like some bizarre ones. Lots of cowboy stuff. But because of my ethnic background, because nobody can really figure out what I am. And so I could play like a whole range of characters. So like I got, and like what they, when they like you, they use you a lot. So I got booked a lot for them and they were great, but it was at that shoot and shooting one of those where I was like, I've got it. Like, this is like enough is enough. So the next day I went home. I didn't get 100 pills after work like I normally did that day. I woke up the next day and I was supposed to go to shoot another cover of the next day, like at 6 a.m. And I'm sitting there brushing my teeth and I could barely stand up. Like my body was just like buckling. I texted my agency and said, or email, whatever, and said, I can't go to work. I'm going to the emergency room. And I had internal bleeding, massive internal bleeding in my intestines from an intestinal ulcer. And that's where you said, like, the intestines, like, but I didn't know because I wasn't passing blood. I wasn't like when I would throw up, there was no blood coming up. There was no blood in my urine or stool or anything like that. So I didn't know. But I was losing weight. People were commenting and like, you know, why are you losing so much weight? I'm like, oh, I'm just, you know, changing it up a bit. But all the signs were there. And I finally, like, they got me on some iron supplements to try and help rebuild my blood cell count, stuff like that. So that was really the final rock bottom that I could hit where I said, okay, I'm 35 years old now. I've been doing this for 15 years, give or take. It's not working. I mean, this plan of mine, I'm living a life that I'm not meant to be living and I'm not enjoying and I'm struggling and I've got to do something different. And when we talk about that stigma for years, it was like, you know, people will say, what about therapy? And I'd be like, therapy's for wimps, therapy's for losers, therapy's for, I'm not going to sit there and have somebody judge me and I'm not going to pay somebody to sit there and judge me for all the things that I've done. I got it covered. Thanks, but no thanks. And that's when I finally said.
We all up in that what happens in the house stays in the house era. And I know that kind of didn't help either.
Very much so. Very much so. And it was like people would see me and, you know, again, it's our natural disposition to judge a book by its cover and be like, oh, there's Jonathan, the international model. And, you know, he's super fit. And I felt like a fraud because I felt like the person that they'd saw on the outside was not who I was on the inside. I felt on the inside, I was broken. I was shattered. I was empty. I was all these things. And everybody would see everybody be like, hey, what's up? And I'd be like, hey, great. And then I'd go home and be like, I can't, like, I'd take the mask off. And I can't realize that, like, you know, I'm living this life where it's not me. And
So I dove into therapy, and I went to a therapist, and I thought for many years, it was like, I don't want to waste money on it. Meanwhile, I've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on drugs and alcohol and all that kind of stuff. So I was like, oh, I think I can afford to pitch a little bit over this way and for something. And it changed, you know, it started to change my life, but it was, things got heavy after that because I was unpacking 15 years of nicely placed, compartmentalized boxes of trauma and things that I hadn't dealt with. And I'll just put this over here and I'll forget about that. And I'll push the sexual assault over here and I'll just put the eating disorder on top of that one. And they're kind of balancing. And then they started to fall, man. I started talking about them and I had no distractions or substances to run to. And it was heavy. But you know what? I said to myself, I am going to do this. And with my all or nothing mentality and with my athlete's mentality as well, I would say too, because I've been an athlete all my life and I love the challenge of, like, you know, being in the game, and I still play hockey 4 times a week and I just love playing sport. But I always wanted to play against their best player. Like, if I was the best player in the
team, still fighting?
No, I'm not. I loved when I was on sports teams and stuff like that, and they'd be like, okay, Jonathan, your goal is, their best player on their team is this person. I was like, okay, perfect. I want that challenge. So that's how I looked at it. And I was like, but it was bleak and it was dark and it was, you know, there were so many other times I thought, I got to take the easy way out. I can't do this. And I would find a little bit of positivity, like that day. I would try and focus on the positive. And like I talk about a lot, like some days will seem bleak, empty, and like there's nothing to live for or nothing positive. And then I'll look over my dog and she'll do something silly. And that will just be my little positivity for the day. That would be all I'd have for the day, but I would try and focus on that. And I love that little dog. Like, I like nobody's business because she got me out of the house. And it, you know, I had a responsibility when I picked her up, when I got her, that I was going to provide for her and give her the best life that I could. And, you know, grow up on a farm, we learned that like our animals are reliant upon us. It doesn't matter how you feel that day. It doesn't matter if it's minus 40 degrees. It doesn't matter, whatever. You have to get up and do it. And she got me out of the house and she helped me so many times. And she was my positivity for that day so many times. And then more and more, my positivity started to grow and I had more things to look at. And it was still lots of heavy lifting. And every day, as you guys know, is, you know, some heavy lifting. There are going to be good days and bad days, but it's, you know, trying to just slowly focus on the positivity. And I remember when I would feel something positive, or if I was feeling completely down, I would write to myself, like, you can go to the grocery store, because I started having anxiety about everything. And I would paste that on my wall. So every time I'd walk to my bathroom or my kitchen, I would see these little notes to myself. And I've never said that before on any other podcast, but I would write these things and I'd write lists of things that I like, you got this, like you can do this and you can beat this and this is not going to beat you. And I needed those affirmations because I wasn't telling anybody. I was very much, again, just doing it on my own, the way that I do things, but I needed to see those things. I needed to hear those things and needed to hear them for myself. And slowly the tide started to turn. And I remember when I was in the thick of, you know, my drugs and stuff like that. And I told my dad, I'm like, I think I'm going to move. I just need to change the scenery. And he said, look, I don't know what you're going through. I know you're going through some stuff. I don't know what it is exactly. You can tell me as much as you want. I can't force you to tell me, but don't think that moving is going to solve your problems, because your problems are going to follow you no matter where you go. So if you're moving because you think that it's going to solve your problems, forget that. So I really took that to heart. And when I moved down to Texas, I was finally in a good enough place where I was moving towards opportunity and not running away from anything anymore. I had done the work. I'd done, you know, 2.5 years, whatever it was, of intensive therapy and personal healing and learning and educating. And then I saw an opportunity to try something new and to, you know, come down here. And I was moving in a positive mindset towards an opportunity and towards a new adventure and towards a new opportunity, and not running from my demons, because, yeah, like I said, they follow you around. So that's kind of the long and the short of it of what I've yeah, what I've kind of been through and what brought me to where I'm at and where I'm at now.
And it's kind of, I remember this story talking to a guy, and it's just about you moving. I actually moved away recently. It's been almost 3 years now that I moved to New York from Virginia. And it was like my big change. It's kind of like when everything kind of got together for me too. I actually started really dealing with my mental health. And I too had a therapist, even though she quit on me. But yeah, I always just got to say that just to make sure she watched. You know, like, I didn't need you for real. But but I moved away too. But I was talking to somebody recently, and he was addicted to heroin for 15 years. And he moved away and was living in California. He was a New Yorker, and he lived in California. But he had to come back. So he came back to New York, and he said as soon as he got off the subway, he wanted heroin again. So he got his ass back on that train, got on a plane, and went back to California. So sometimes it is that muscle memory. You know, sometimes I feel like you do kind of need to start over and move away or get out of certain situations because that muscle memory won't let you go anywhere.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and it could be anything. It doesn't mean you have to move away from home, but it does take sometimes leaving something.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I totally agree with that. And I had, now that I'd done the work and gotten sober, but I didn't see it was very, you know, Toronto's a very expensive city. And, you know, I felt like I was stuck in that way, like getting back into the real estate market and looking at, like, you know, how much, like, doing well, making six figures and barely, like, living paycheck to paycheck. I'm like, what's going on here? Like, what? So I'm, you know, that kind of, yeah, it's extremely expensive. And get to where we are now and, like, why I'm talking about this stuff now. And I said before that I wanted to, like, talk about forgiveness. And the biggest thing that I've learned in the last year, and the reason why I've started to talk about this stuff publicly, is because of, I finally, within the last year, started to forgive myself. And I forgive myself for, you know, becoming an alcoholic and, you know, going down the path of drug addict, like doing, you know, drugs, addiction and stuff like that. Because I always say I was just doing my best with what I could. I was trying. I didn't have all the tools. I didn't know all the, like, the right things to do, but I was trying my best with what I had. And I can't go back and change my path. And I wouldn't change my path because all of those things, as dark and as bleak as they were, they've made me who I am today. And I needed to go through all those things. But I've also forgiven myself for the things that have happened to me that are out of my control, like my mom passing away and like the sexual assault, because I didn't choose that. But I don't forgive the person, but I don't even remember the person. Like, I did such a good job at, like, disassociating, like, I couldn't, you know, they could walk by me today and I wouldn't know. But those are, you know, just unfortunate facts of life that are exactly that. They're facts of life. They're part of my life and they're part of what made me. And I didn't choose that, but I forgive the fact that I went through that. And that's okay, because, again, it's brought me to where I am now. And I don't know who I would be without all of those things. And there were a lot of great times too, like, throughout, for sure. But, you know, it's that forgiving myself and actually, like, you know, when you know, people tell you that, or people talk about, like, oh yeah, people told me I need to go get help and stuff like that. And you're like, okay, whatever. Or maybe people will go through the motions and go to rehab for somebody else. And it's not until you do things for yourself that it really sticks. And with my quitting addictions and knowing that I was doing it for myself, and with my forgiveness and knowing that I had truly and am forgiving myself, you know, that really has helped me immensely, and to be able to talk about these things and to be able to admit to the things that I've been through and the mistakes that I've made or things that have happened, and know that they don't change the person that I am today. And I'm, you know, just working hard to try and be a good person and live my life and keep learning every day. And yeah, just do my best like everybody else, just a regular Joe.
Definitely. I mean, we kind of have a saying here that I'm always the best. I'm better today than I was 5 minutes ago. I'm better now than I was 5 minutes ago. Continue to grow. I feel like Rebecca, Rebecca had a whole notebook of, like, notes and stuff.
But, you know, we've already touched on everything.
I was like, Rebecca didn't get to ask a question.
No, it's okay. No, everything that I had written down was already answered.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that your voice is heard.
Hey, my voice is heard.
Okay.
Is there anything, like, that was specifically, like, on podcasts people, like, want to ask you about, like, specific things that are general, anything like that I did just talk about that you guys want to ask me about, or anything that, like, anywhere you want to comment on or like anything. I don't know. Just I'm here, man. Like you guys, I love your vibe. And
thanks.
The only thing that came to my mind, and I wasn't really even sure if I should ask because I was afraid it might be a bit intrusive. I don't know. But see, the whole mom passing away thing is a kind of hits home with me as well because my mom is gone too. But did you ever find yourself angry at her for passing? I mean, I know there's nothing she could do about it, but I know I find myself sometimes, even though my mom, of course, couldn't help passing either, but I go through the grieving process even still. Every day I think about her. Some days I'm like, Mom, why aren't you here? Or Mom, why did you leave? You know, I have those moments where I'm just, yeah. Did you ever have those moments?
Absolutely. And that's, nobody's ever asked me that. And I think it's something that like you said, that you've experienced, and like, we're in this club that unfortunately where our moms have passed away and we've experienced that. And it's interesting you say that, and because like I said, I've never had, but yes, absolutely. I mean, there were so many things, like so many times where I was like, you're not going to see me get married. You're not going to, or I could really use your help with this or whatever it was. Like I felt the whole spectrum of emotions with regards to, but there were absolutely times where it was like, yeah, like there was misplaced frustration or anger or whatever you want to call it, where it was like, you know, I never blamed the situations that I got myself into on my mom and it, her passing, because I know it was a catalyst, but I made my choices after that. But you're absolutely right. Like there were times where it was like, man, I could really use you right now. And I really need you, or, you know, you don't get, I know that I believe she's watching, and she, you know, she never got to see me follow in her footsteps and, you know, model internationally and, you know, that kind of stuff. And there's, but yes, to answer your question, absolutely. Yes, I did. And it's, yeah, it's the first time anybody's asked me that. That really hits home.
Yeah. It's tough for me too. Whenever I hear anybody on our show talk about losing a mother or any sort of grievance of any kind, it brings it up for me too. And it's a tough topic for me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure it is.
Sorry.
I appreciate that. And I'm sorry you did as well. It's, you know, there's no handbook, there's no guidebook, and we all handle things differently, right? And, you know, we like I said, we try our best, and it's just an unfortunate fact of our lives that, you know, that's what's happened to us, and we could only go forward and try to. I mean, there are other options, but we're not going to take those options. We're going to just try and do our best to keep moving forward. But yeah, there is definitely that, that feeling for sure.
It's kind of these conversations that still makes me always think about God and the existence of a higher power, because I'm like, you had somebody create me. Now I love them, and I spend my whole life loving them. And then you take them away for me to hope that I see them in my next lifetime or when I die, and those, like, that is true as hell. But that's a different conversation and a different podcast. But
no, I totally get what you're saying, and like I've had a lot of ins and outs about that with spirituality and stuff like that. But like, yeah, you're right. It's hard to come to terms with these things and try to like make sense of it. And you're like, wait, how is this? What's going on here? But we don't have it all figured out. And, you know, we're just trying to get it all, you know, do our best as individuals to try and figure it out and hold on to whatever we believe or whatever, you know, but it is, definitely something that I've thought about that as well.
It's about the journey and taking the journey.
So what do you do now for, I mean, I know you do the houses, so you're flipping houses, helping out with personal training.
We know he does hockey 4 days a week.
Yeah, so you're keeping busy. So that's the way you're handling all these emotions now. You did the therapy, so you're in a good place.
I am. I just recently started going back to therapy probably about 8-9 months ago, something like that. Just more as like a check-in. Like when I went to therapy before, it was like dire. Like I need to learn how to live as a sober functioning adult, because I've never been that. Like when from the day that I was 21 till 35, there was always something. So, but now it's more of like a check-in. And,
just the same way that I go to the gym 6 days a week and play hockey 4 days a week and that kind of stuff, I think it's important to check in mentally. And I have learned how to function and keep better tabs on my addictive personality and live a more balanced life. That's what I need to learn how to do is learn to balance. And it's balancing work because, yeah, I am still modeling and I'm, like I said, flipping houses and still training clients. And I'm still, you know, physical activity is very important to me. It's a very, I think it's important to me very mentally. And like, it's a very meditative thing to be out on the ice and just kind of be able to like check out and do that kind of stuff. But I was going to the gym 6 days a week. So I was playing hockey 4 days a week and I was running 6 miles a day. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. There goes Obsessor Jonathan. I think that my knees are telling me that the 6 miles a day, we don't need to do that. Like that's, so I'm very cognizant of that. And I eat healthy. I enjoy eating healthy, but I also am a big believer in you have to live your life. Like whenever I'm talking, I've always told my clients, and I'm a big believer, I don't think there's this thing as a cheat meal. Cheating implies you're doing something negative. You have to live your life. And if you are having that cheat meal the whole time you're eating it, you're thinking, I shouldn't be doing this. I'm cheating. I'm doing bad. I'm being bad. Like, no, it's like, if you want a 3-fruit roll up at 3 o'clock in the morning, that's a different story.
Though, okay. I'm a single Ivy now, right? And
what's the single thing got to do with it?
Because I've been single, I haven't had any sex.
Oh, so. My God.
So they say that fruit roll-up releases the same endorphins. There's extra.
The box. It's written on the box.
Yeah, right? Really, really, really fine print. They're really fine print. Yeah.
I'm still trying to figure it all out, right? And it's why I figure it out. I don't want to be intimate with nobody. So I need something to be intimate with. And me, I'm going to tell you how bad it is, though.
Only referral.
I was doing a TikTok video. I was making a TikTok video. And it wasn't until like watching it a week later that I had like roll up wrappers all around my neck. But I wanted to say something before we go. Because so you were saying that Toronto was expensive.
Right.
But in my mind, or for some reason, I heard trauma is expensive.
Oh, well, that's for sure. And that should be a shirt, t-shirt.
Right. Yeah. And I was like, that's kind of like the basis of this is basically, you know, it's kind of like you said, here you are, you know, modeling, but yet you're living paycheck to paycheck. But it was dealing with your trauma that you were kind of like, you know, kind of being wasteful. I'm going to say wasteful, but, you know, it's still being wasteful. So it's like, I think that's kind of like a big takeaway from this episode. Trauma is expensive. And until you start dealing with your trauma, you always going to be broke.
It's very true.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah. Broken physically, yeah. Emotionally, mentally, spiritually, financially. And it's, you know, it's the Toronto accent. People from Toronto, we don't say Toronto. We say Toronto. We don't pronounce the second T. So it kind of sounds like trauma, but Toronto, like Toronto. If you're from Toronto, that's the way you say Toronto. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it is extremely, and it's, you know, that becomes your priority because that's your only outlet to help with the demons that are inside of you and you're dealing with mentally and stuff like that is to find that money. And I always had money for that. I mean, I skipped a few meals, I'm sure, but I always had money for my vices because, you know, your priorities and where your priorities stand and stuff like that. But yeah, trauma is expensive. Let's collab on the t-shirts.
Yes, I'm with you because even though you didn't make it, I made it, but I misheard you. So I guess I cut you in. Three.
Crystal, you got me. Crystal's witness. Crystal's witness.
Look, Crystal was just good. Out of everything you said, all she heard was that you weren't married. And she was like, yes.
No, one day I hope to be, but that's the thing too, is like, I've gone through so many people like, oh, why aren't you married? It's like, well, I've gone through so many phases of my life and gone through so many things where like I dated people and, you know, been through different relationships when I was in different places. And sometimes I just needed somebody to get high with. Sometimes I needed to be on my own or whatever. And, you know, I think I'm a big believer and you'd have to learn to become the best version of yourself or work on being the best version of yourself. Then you'll attract that kind of a person. And, you know, I'm just trying to do my thing. And I just didn't know that she was sitting behind the camera in upstate New York. So,
and we don't have no problem coming to Texas, but we got to go together because we don't know you.
Oh,
so we got
to go. It's non-negotiable. You guys are all coming down.
And that's just an excuse because I think you're a great guy and I've never even met you.
He is like the main one that says you can't judge a book by its cover.
Yeah.
Okay, true story.
But no, I you know what's kind of funny, because if we would have talked 20 years ago, you were a person that I probably would have hated, because
I would have hated myself.
No, because you know what, I grew up right. No, but me, to me, it was the fact that I always grew up and I was a feminine boy and always known as pretty, and I didn't play sports, and I wasn't masculine enough, so no one invited me to play sports, and you know, I kind of went through those things. And then as I got older, I found out that I was really sick and sickly, and even now, like, I have a hypothalamus issue. So my body overheats. So even now, like, my doctor's like, you're probably like the first person I've ever had to tell, do not work out.
Really?
So to me, wow. For years, I've wanted to be a regular guy. And it wasn't until my healing stage that I'm like, I'm dope as shit. But, you know, it took a long time to get there.
Yeah.
So I guess in my own way, I kind of went through a whole phase. I think we all do. We all go through those phases. I wanted to ask, was there anything that you wanted to say to our audience that we didn't let you say?
No, not really. I mean, I really appreciate you guys having me on, and I'm really thankful to be able to be a part of what you guys are doing and what you're doing and you're doing so well with. And just want to like congratulate you guys on that, and you know, very genuinely say thank you for letting me be a part of it. And you know, I love meeting new people like yourselves and connecting and having these conversations. And you know, back to the stuff we talked about with regards to our mom, you know, that was really like something I'll take away a lot from this conversation, but that was something that I hadn't really thought of or you know, brought up in a long time. And I appreciate that for you for doing that, because it is something that I'd forgotten that I had felt. And I'm glad that I've been reminded of that. You know, I'm very glad that I've, you know, been able to. And I love the way you guys are doing your show. And it's, you know, life's too short to not have fun. And I think that, like, when we're talking about serious stuff and we're talking about serious issues and stuff like that, like, we can still, you know, find that, you know, let's have some fun with it, and let's, you know, let's keep it light and have some fun too. So I really do appreciate that part of it, because a lot of the podcasts I do are very, you know, very, very serious, very, you know, very, very much. But yeah, just, I appreciate you guys, and I want to connect with as many people as possible. I love hearing from people. I love learning from people. Like, opening up like this has given me the opportunity to, first of all, I don't think I have it all figured out. Like, first, let me, like I said before, with regards to drinking, I'm not, like, I'm still trying to figure it out. Use my story as if you're going through something, maybe there's something you can take from it, some tools that I've learned, or use it as a do not do this. Like, stay away from that path. Let me save you 15, 20 years of, like, don't do that. But it's been wonderful connecting with people and learning from them and connecting on social media and people reaching out and messaging and learning, and just for the genuine sake of wanting to help your fellow human. It's a wonderful thing, yeah. You know, like, to...
Now, in season 3, one of a big thing for us is that we're focusing on love, self-love, love for self. So we did want to get your take on that and just give our audience something on some love.
I think it all starts with self-love. And, you know, like, I think there's a big difference between loving yourself and being in love with yourself. And I think that's a big thing that's happening with regards to social media and the narcissism and the, you know, the putting out the picture of perfection that's going on, and everybody, you know, getting the external validation and stuff like that and being in love with themselves. But I think it's a very important thing to love yourself and to forgive yourself when you make mistakes, but love yourself, take care of yourself, whatever that looks like for you. But don't fall in love with yourself, because that's a very dark, that's a whole different way to go with it. And there is a line of self-love and in love with self. And I think that what you guys are talking about, self-love, is important to, like...
Yeah, no, that was actually pretty dope. You did.
I like your answer. She's over there swooning. No, like, we're like,
ah. Oh. I see
how you're going to be followed by her in 5 minutes, okay?
Oh, I'm going and checking your followers right now. You followed me last night. It was an important thing, because I put out my social media version of what I wanted into the world, and that's fine, because I'm a very private person, but I felt it was important for me to let down that veil. And I'm not pretending that everything's perfect, and I wasn't trying to before. I just didn't think that people had access to, and people still don't have access to certain things. I'm very private with some other things, but that whole idea of, you know, just the real, like, what people are actually going through, and not... Everything that glitters isn't necessarily gold, and, you know, just being real and
loving yourself, and again, not being in love with yourself and not looking for external validation. Get your validation from the person you see in the mirror and the people that are around you, the people who are your ride or dies, and not like, you know, random people who are hitting the like button. That's cool and all, but when it comes down to it, if you get sick, if some, you know, who's going to be there for you? Who's going to be there with you? Who are you, like, who are your people? So,
right. Yeah. Well, we kind of say the same thing. I mean, we started this podcast. So we're like, I don't care if just one person watches, you know, yeah. As long as you can just help one person. But it's kind of like you said, it starts with the self-love, making sure that you have a safe place and that if you need help, you seek it. And most likely you need help with something. So go seek it.
Yeah.
Because remember, drama is expensive.
Drama is expensive. Copyright. Trademark.
Oh, thank you for being on here. It was great chatting with you and great hearing your story. And I'm glad you're doing a lot better. And I'm sure someone out there will have benefited from your story.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. And we'll stay in contact and keep track of you because we're healing as well. So you know what? We get through this thing together. Right? Once again, thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you so much.
Thank you guys.
Thank you guys for watching. So much.
And
I appreciate you.
And with that, episode of the Fucking Feelings Podcast. Thank you all for tuning in and engaging in another intense and real discussion on understanding and navigating through our feelings. Don't forget, we're here each Wednesday bringing you brand new episodes filled with stories, advice, and perspectives to help you handle those fucking feelings. So set a reminder on your calendar, grab your headphones, and join us every week. And if you're interested in exploring more ways to deal with life's stresses, make certain to tune in to our sister podcast. Trauma is expensive. Dive deep into discussions on managing trauma, building resilience, and fostering healing with new episodes dropping every Monday. Make sure to subscribe, rate, and comment on both podcasts on your favorite podcast platform. Remember, each comment and rating can catapult us further towards reaching those individuals who could really use our discussions. Your feedback is invaluable. Before we close, we want to remind you that discussing feelings is never a sign of weakness, but a display of courage. Stay brave, stay strong, and keep feeling those fucking feelings. Until next week, take care and keep the conversation going.